Thanks, everybody, for moving up a little closer so we have a better discussion here. I'm Rosie Stevenson, moderating for Mark today. Mark Elwood is an artist living in Atlanta, Georgia, with a 10-year-long career as a concept artist in the technical sector before becoming a stay-at-home dad. He's currently working on The Glass Looker, a graphic novel portraying Joseph Smith Jr.'s money-digging adventures. Before we begin, silence your phones, of course, and we'll have concessions open after this. Come back at 1:45 for the next session after this is over. Can the founding mythology of Mormonism be presented in a way that is entertaining and acceptable to both the faithful and skeptic? In this presentation, Mark Elwood describes his journey as a comic book artist to do just that through an illustrated narrative. He will also display some of his artwork and describe his creative process. And I think he's got some lovely cards for you to take here. Thanks, Mark.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much for coming, everyone. So thanks for the great introduction. I'm just going to go in a little more detail. So first, a little about me. I'm an artist. I have a background in concept art and aerospace engineering, creating renderings of illustrations and animations for NASA, the Air Force, Virgin Galactic, and more. I worked in that field for over 10 years. It's a highly technical field. You have to draw things correctly. You can't make up a lot of details, and so you have to be creative within the data that is provided. When my son was born, my wife and I decided it was a good opportunity to transition into creating my own art, which happened to coincide with my newfound obsession of reading about Mormon history. So I'm a stay-at-home dad now, with a very informed toddler when it comes to early Mormon stories. I became fascinated in early Mormon stories simply as that, stories, legends, and myths. I think that myths and legends weave a rich tapestry that is Mormonism. These are unique stories to our own culture, and they help explain who we are. They not only tell us about the characters in the stories, they inform us of the perspectives of the individuals relating the stories. Okay. So, there's a spectrum of stories in our culture. Familiar, faith-promoting stories that make your bosom burn. Mainstream stories that are okay to be shared with the non-Mormon world, and stories that you might chuckle off, unfamiliar stories that might be difficult to fit into one's understanding of the gospel, and strange stories that have a unique propensity to be brought up in fast and testimony meeting. You know, the kind that make you shift uncomfortably in your pew. Shocking stories you stumble across that are put on a shelf and to be explained in the next life. And of course, at the end of the spectrum is anti-Mormon lies. What I've illustrated here is we've got on the far side over there the experience of David Whitmer's like three witness experience. This is the very large, enormous black snake that Lucy Harris talks about when she was trying to find the plates that protect. It was in the snow and it protected the plates. The center kind of sketch there is going to be a giant that frightens away some diggers when they're attempting to get some treasure, and he's perched on the edge of a barn. The next one here is a illustration of the first miracle of the church. It's the Newell Knight possession and exorcism event. And then over here is the, on the far side, we've got an illustration of Orson Sanders' description of the treasure guardian angel, which is very different from our understanding as the mainstream narrative. So actually, all these stories here, come to think of it, are coming from a believing source, except for this one here. So, oh, let's see. Where a story falls on the spectrum does not necessarily represent if a story is true or not. There are faith-promoting stories that we all grew up with, learning that are not historically accurate, and there are stories that are challenging to one's faith that have a strong historical basis, and vice versa. I think an example might be like Brigham Young's Transfiguration, where he took on the appearance of Joseph Smith. There's just not a lot of, I think, history behind that. But all right, so I call the stories trending towards the less comfortable end of the spectrum, Lost Mormonism. And I started illustrating these stories and collecting them at my blog of the same name. These stories may not be lost to Sunstone attendees and historians who have devoted hours to the research, but I think to the common Mormon, you know, they may not have heard of some of these things. In many ways, it is also lost to many former Mormons who may have left the church and never looked back, and they don't, they never got to experience some of these fascinating stories. We learn myths and legends before we learn application. Imagine the scriptures without stories. Helaman's 2,000 Stripling Warriors, David and Goliath, Noah's Ark, Abinadi and King Noah. We learn these stories before we are able to articulate the morals we are supposed to learn from them. Art is obviously an essential part of learning these stories. I think they impact the viewer in ways that words cannot. After all, a picture is worth 1,000 words. Of course, art can be off base. I don't know that King Noah actually had jaguars there in his throne room, or that the Nephites had massive, you know, Roman metal style armor. But it was an artistic choice, perhaps, by the artist to portray and evoke a certain response from the person enjoying the art. So, if you'll bear with me, I'd like to go over just my journey and process a little bit, how I got to the point where I'm writing a graphic novel today. So for me, it all began out of curiosity and with this quote here, I'll just read it real fast, I guess. In the year 1823, my father's family met with a great affliction by the death of my eldest brother, Alvin. The month of October 1825, I hired with an old gentleman by the name of Josiah Stoll, who lived in Chenango County, state of New York. He had heard something of a silver mine, which, having been opened by the Spaniards in Harmony, Susquehanna County, state of Pennsylvania, and had, previous to my hiring him, been digging in order, if possible, to discover the mine. After I went to live with him, he took me and the rest of the hands to dig for the silver mine, at which I continued to work for nearly a month without success in our undertaking, and finally I prevailed with the old gentleman to cease digging after it. Hence arose the very prevalent story of my having been a money digger. So I wondered, you know, what were these very prevalent stories or story? So I decided to write a short comic focusing on Joseph's treasure digs. I knew a little bit about it. I knew there was a hat and a stone, and I knew there had to be more to the story. I discovered that there were numerous treasure digging accounts. Keeping track of them also became a challenge and a hobby. Here is a chart of some of the items that I found that Joseph searched for or was ascribed to him in some of his treasure quests. There are kegs of gold and silver, pots of money, golden furniture, iron chests, seer stones, salt wells, gold and silver mines, and even a box of golden watches, and of course, the golden plates themselves. Looking at this grid, you can see that at least the legend surrounding Joseph's treasure digging was extensive. Each one of these items represents a story, and some are more detailed than others, obviously. Here is a map representing the overall treasure dig locations that Joseph may have participated in New York and Pennsylvania. Here is a zoom in on just one area of that map, in the South Bainbridge area, where Josiah Stoll lived, kind of lived where those two are right there. Anywhere there is a hole in the official narrative, pun intended, there is a story to tell. Obviously, some of these stories have more, you know, details than others, and but some of them have a great adventure story with them. So, you know, as I'm looking at these things, I thought, you know, what was Joseph's role in these digs? Did he bring home enough money to support his family? What skills did he employ? The questions then enter the magical realm. If a seer stone was used, which stone was it? And did the digging crew use a magic circle? Were there enchantments or animal sacrifices? And finally, we dive into myth. Did the treasure actually exist? And if so, who put it there? You know, pirates like William Kidd, Native Americans, long-lost civilizations, bands of robbers, or just demons themselves placing it there. What type of supernatural phenomenon were observed at the dig site? In the larger picture on the right side of the screen, I've drawn something that they experienced in many treasure digs, which was that of slippery treasure. You know, where the item they were searching for would shift and move underground as they got closer and always seeking out of reach. Other times before the treasure could be reached, a frightening experience such as this old schoolhouse lighting up inexplicably would frighten them away, scattering the digging crew. And of course, a few stories even talk about a demon or a ghost appearing and frustrating the digging efforts. But who is telling these stories? Many of these stories do come from hostile sources, but I'd like to read this quote from Michael Quinn, Dr. Michael Quinn, on his groundbreaking work, Mormonism and the Magical Worldview. Both scholars and casual readers should give greater attention to the reports by Palmyra neighbors of statements and actions the neighbors witnessed. The hostility of contemporary reports and reminiscent accounts is not an adequate basis for assuming distortion in documents of the Mormon past. Eyewitness reports from hostile Palmyra neighbors and Mormon devotional reminiscence must both be evaluated in terms of other evidence. As I read these stories, I realized I did not know too much about the individual people in Joseph's neighborhood and or their credibility or their motives, but the more I read, the more I became fascinated by the people recounting the stories. Who were Joseph's neighbors? Why were some of them so hostile? What did they think of the Smith family and Joseph's discovery of the gold plates? I fell down a rabbit hole, and I spent probably too much time drawing all the different characters and trying to keep track of them, but for me it was just a way to visually keep track of things and kind of attach a face to these individuals. I made a ton of family trees and things like that as well. I joked with my wife that I might have drawn the whole town of Palmyra, but I'm sure I did not, so... But some of these characters are absolutely fascinating. Characters that, like Lumen Walters, Alva Beeman, Willard Chase, Peter Ingersoll, Lorenzo Saunders. On the left, or on the right, rather. Your left, my right. We've got Sally Chase. One of the descriptions talks about how she mounted her seer stone inside of a paddle. And that's the type of paddle that would be used for laundry there, her beating the laundry. So... And her stone was small, too, about the size of a thumb. So anyway, so even familiar characters like Martin Harris, David Whitmer, and Joseph Smith became more real and complex. For instance, in my research, I ran across this story that was absolutely, that I absolutely fell in love with. It was, really brings a human element to Joseph Smith. It's an account of a Miss Palmer, who is a little girl, actually, in my illustration here. She tells a story when she was just a child of playing in her parents' cornfields while her brothers worked. At the end of the day, her brothers refused to carry her home, and she started to cry. Joseph Smith Jr. scooped her up and carried her home. This story might be categorized as an anti-Mormon source because later she goes on to talk about how Joseph was led away by superstition and that after his first vision, which they called the dream of the dream of a sweet mind or something like that. They later say in the same account that he needed to be crushed and stopped, you know. So we don't hear that story because of the source it comes from. But as I ran into this type of story, I was like, what position should I take in my graphic novel? If I illustrate these lesser-known stories, I could easily become labeled as anti. As I pondered this problem, I decided to illustrate the stories as if each source is operating in good faith and telling the story as they understand it to be. In other words, I take them at face value. So in my graphic novel, Joseph really will encounter an angel and obtain physical gold plates. He will speak for God and start a church, but he will also encounter demons, treasure guardians, talking toad-like creatures, all the fantastic elements. It's difficult to be considered neutral in an area as fraught as early Mormon history, but I'm hoping that I can be deemed not to be picking a side in telling this story. But if I am picking a side, I'm picking Martin Harris's side. Basically, I'm writing this book from the perspective of someone like Martin Harris, who without him, obviously, Mormonism would not exist. Martin completely believed in Joseph, you know, whatever he said. He believed in Joseph's ability to channel both the supernatural and the divine, which was common in that time, although we have a hard time understanding it today. On the right, I've made a parody of the X-Files poster. Instead of a UFO, I've portrayed something unusual that Martin saw in the sky, a flaming sword let down out of heaven, which pointed in the cardinal directions and then downward at the hill. In my story, much like the X-Files, I don't know if you all know the X-Files, but the truth is out there, but it's never fully explained. It's up to each person to determine what to believe. Okay, so thanks for bearing with me on that. To explain my process. Now that I've done that, I want to give an example of how I've managed to weave together several stories into what I hope is one cohesive narrative of a story we're all very familiar with. Joseph's acquisition of the gold plates on the night of September 22nd, 1827. In my own graphic novel, I'm not actually at this point yet, so these are just sketches I made for this presentation. So, let's start with Joseph's own words. In his own history, he says, "At length, the time arrived for obtaining the plates, the Urim and Thummim, and the breastplate. On the 22nd day of September, 1827, having gone as usual at the end of another year to the place where they were deposited, the same heavenly messenger delivered them up to me with this charge, that I should be responsible for them, that if I should let them go carelessly or through any neglect of mine, I should be cut off. But that if I would use all my endeavors to preserve them until he, the messenger, should call for them, they should be protected." All right, so that's what Joseph says about that day, as far as I know. Then here, so let's add in a second witness. We love second witnesses in Mormonism, so let's add in his mother's details that she's going to add here. All right, so Lucy says that she was working late one night. Around midnight, Joseph and Emma left the house in their riding clothes. Lucy says she prayed all night for Joseph's success at getting the plates. Joseph and Emma borrow Joseph Knight's wagon and horse since he was there visiting. And then, do this part, hold on. Then Joseph then received the plates from the angel. Not far from the hill, Joseph took out his pocket knife and removed some bark from a rotting log. He put the plates in the hole, put the bark back on, and put some old stuff over the hole to conceal the hiding place. He then goes home, and he arrives in time for breakfast. Just as Joseph Knight was getting worried, someone had stolen his wagon and horse. Lucy Mack feared another failed attempt at the plates. So Joseph shows his mother the key he discovered with the plates and reassured her that all is well. All right, so that's just with one other source added in. Now, let's go ahead and do what I'm calling the expanded edition, where you try to stitch together lots of details from lots of accounts, so this will be fun, I promise. All right, so we begin the same. Joseph and Emma leave at midnight, and Lucy prays all night. Sorry, the hold up here is me turning these pages. Sorry. They leave with a borrowed horse and wagon, and Martin Harris actually adds that they were there, Joseph. The Stoll and Joseph Knight were there for a money dig the night prior. So, just kind of side note there. So, they arrive at the hill. Emma is to face away from the hill. Joseph crosses a fence. He hears screeching and screaming as soon as he crosses the fence near the hill from demons. Joseph arrives at the spot he went to prior the year prior, but he discovers nothing is there. And the source for each one is below here, if you're interested. He looks in his stone, seeking inspiration, trying to figure out what's going on. And he discovers in his stone that there are some markings on the ground, some peculiar markings on the ground. He gets a revelation on the spot and is able to decipher the markings. They are instructions which indicate where the plates have moved. The stone is larger than before, but Joseph levers it with little effort with the help of superhuman strength. He then digs down until he is about waist deep, where he finds the lid to a stone box, which has a ring on it. Last year, he attempted to pull, and he was unable to move it. But this year, he removes the lid with ease. And Sidney Rigdon, actually, the description is he tells about how he removed it, just popped it right off. No problem. Under the lid, he sees the plates and is able to remove them without any forces preventing him. Inside the box, he sees three cement pillars that were holding up the gold plates on top of a chest plate, and the spectacles are there. Also in the box was the golden ball with two spindles and a sword hilt and chain, the blade having long since rusted away. The angel explains gives his spiel there. Protect the plates, yada, yada. And then immediately a mounted spirit suddenly appears and demands the plates be returned to the earth. Suddenly, thousands of demons, which would later be upgraded to millions of demons by Brigham Young, appear. And then, even more fantastic, demons appear on his shoulders and they're everywhere, in the air, in the hills. Needless to say, Joseph runs. He dodges behind trees and shrubs. Okay, this part's awesome. The ghostly rider pursues Joseph with, and I promise I'm not making up this detail, a scorpion sword unsheathed. Suddenly, celestial lights in the sky burst into view. A ball of fire flashes overhead. A bow appears in the sky, and angelic soldiers dressed like Revolutionary War soldiers are marching to the hill. This is getting epic, okay? Joseph's eyes are open, and he sees angels fighting demons as he's retreating down the hill, I guess. However, the chief devil traps him in a whirlwind. Trees are uprooted and thrown about. Oops. Joseph's head is wounded in the encounter with this chief devil. But luckily, Joseph's father arrives and helps Joseph escape. Joseph approaches the fence that he crossed earlier, but he is attacked again, and this time the demon is able to jerk the plates from Joseph's grasp. Joseph is able to recover them, but not before he gets a kick in the behind. This is my son's favorite part. He loves it. It is great. And then one final attack. As he's crossing the fence, he gets hit in the side. He will be bruised for several days after that. All right. And then he puts it in the blog at the bottom of the hill there. A slightly more bruised and battered Joseph arrives home in time for breakfast, showing his mother the key. I can't remember who said it, but there's somebody that says that it was very difficult to get the plates home. So it's an understatement. So sorry. I don't have the source on that offhand. So how did these stories happen? You know, like how did they evolve to be like these? Certainly some of these stories are mean-spirited attempts at making the Joseph story more ridiculous. Some are probably well-meaning big fish stories or gossip that grew with each telling. But with any story is a grain of truth, and it tells us more about the people that told the stories. They are, in my opinion, not completely without merit. What you're left with is an American fantasy story. Instead of dragons, princes, castles, sorcerers, it's a tale of pirates, Indians, seer stones, lost civilization, and faith. I find it fascinating, and I hope you will too. Any questions? So, thanks. Do you use this or? Oh, there it is.
That works.
Hey.
All right. Your artwork's amazing.
Thank you.
This is an awesome presentation. Big question, and this is probably something you've been constantly wrestling with. B.H. Roberts' History of the Church is 7 volumes to cover Joseph Smith's life, and there's no illustrations. yeah. How do you decide what you're including and not? Because everything you covered is prior to Mormonism, prior to the foundation of the church. This is all Joseph Smith magic and occult history. How do you decide what to cull? What are you going to include of actual Mormon history, you know, once you get beyond the foundation of the church? And have you mocked up any illustrations for the Kirtland Temple? Because that's where I really want to see your artwork shine.
Yeah, good questions. So my graphic novel, the scope of it will actually end at publication of the Book of Mormon, okay? So I'm following a kind of a hero's journey. And at that point, I feel like he's, I don't know if you're familiar with Joseph Campbell, but he's returned with the elixir, which is the plates, and he's able to translate them. There's still lots of magical, awesome stuff happening after Kirtland, but man, that's going to be book 2 if I get there. There's some great stuff. But it's a much smaller world, much easier for me to get a handle on when it's just Palmyra, Manchester, Harmony, you know, smaller area. So, all right, Sandra.
Yeah, so, yeah, that was real fun.
Thanks.
But when you get him putting the plates in the log...
Yeah.
Well, what was it? Last year or two, the Mormons had in, I don't know if it was a children's magazine, this thread of the journey of getting the plates and that. And they have... It shows him going with Emma in the wagon to go get the plates, and then it goes on with the story. He doesn't get the plates with the wagon.
Right.
Which doesn't make any sense to me, why you'd put them in the log, go home with the wagon, then later come back and have to carry him.
Right.
But so...
that's what happens.
So I assume you're going to illustrate when he goes back the next day, and these two guys chasing him through the woods. It might have...
I'm going to do three. I'm going to do three.
To be illustrated.
Yeah.
Of the guy hitting him with the rifle butt.
Yeah.
Running through the woods.
Absolutely. And, so it's kind of all the different, you know, each thing has sort of got its own myths and legends, you know. Yeah. And if it's a big event like this, where I bring home the plates, there's lots of accounts that want to add their 2 cents. You know, especially people later that weren't even involved, like Brigham Young, he wants to add himself into the story, you know. And so...
like when he gets home, does he hand him through the window to his mother? Which it just astounds me because you know, like, Mom, here, you know, like, what?
and
right on her foot, you know, I mean, make a great story.
Definitely, and each, you know, that's a whole nother episode, essentially, of getting the plates home. Has some great stories with it as well.
Loved all your illustrations of the residents of Palmyra.
Oh, thank you.
What I'd like. And maybe you're going to do this, but it'd be great to have a blow-up of the township of Palmyra and try to place all these residences where they lived in the area.
Yeah, sure.
As well as do a family tree of these residents, because as we all know, many of them are very related.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Yeah, I think one of the odd relations is, I think, is it Catherine Smith? She marries... She marries into a family that has been not very nice to the Smiths, let's say. I don't remember. Who is it?
Sophronia.
Oh, Sophronia. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. All right, cool. Go ahead.
Is your goal for this to be for Mormons who know who the heck all these people are, or for someone like me who's just interested, and mm-hmm. I'm like, this would be a great thing to read to my kids, and I'd get two pages in, and they're like, Mommy, what is Palmyra? And I'd be like, So is there going to be a non-Mormon introduction to the basics?
Well, the way that I feel like, I mean, you know, most stories you present the world small at first, and you grow gradually. So I think my goal is, yeah, a non-Mormon could pick this up and read it and not have to know, you know, about Palmyra beforehand, essentially. Yeah. Hello.
Hello. First side note that came to mind, we were talking about the residents of Palmyra. Another way, if you're wanting to brush it out, have like a guess who game, yeah. Like all the faces.
Yeah.
Kids can play guess who with each other with all the
That's a good faces. Idea.
But one thing that kind of came to mind from this, and I'm not sure, just wondering if you're one familiar with it. There's a book by Jane Barnes. It's Falling in Love with Joseph Smith. And just why it's kind of significant. It's more of like her personal experience with that. But she has part of it where she writes, it's almost like, for lack of a better word, kind of fan fiction. But it's like her imagining the story of Joseph Smith, like kind of discovering the plates and everything, but also with Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn there.
Oh, wow.
And just kind of like the interactions and the playful dialogue of like Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn trying to like figure out who this character is and all that sort of stuff. And I wonder if you had any familiarity with those kind of like stories or sort of like playful retellings of
there
Joseph
is,
Smith and had any.
I mean, first of all, I like that, you know, that she compares, you know, Huck Finn and Joseph Smith. There is some, like, you know, there's stories of him coon hunting with his buddies. There's lots of great little stories like that. And I hope, you know, I'm not going to be like, now I'm going to write a story about coon hunting. But what I will do is I'll have some of those details that happen as I illustrate some of the other things I'm a little more interested in. So, yeah. Yeah. Good question.
So I appreciate her question about who this is really directed towards. I'm not sure you answered that.
Sure.
So that's kind of my first question. And second, I've always had a bit of an issue with historical fiction because there's always the difficulty of sort of knowing what's historical, what's fiction, and how are those lines blurred. And so I guess I'm wondering, is that something that you sort of struggle with, that you're potentially going to be putting, you know, ideas and people that the people are going to look at these things as being events that actually occurred to a greater extent than what they really did.
Yeah. Okay. So first, the addressing like who I'm writing it for. So you know, first of all, I'm writing it for myself because I love this stuff. But second, I'm writing it for. I just think that these stories are awesome and have never had pictures before. And I feel like that they are something that is unique to Mormonism. You know, we have these great mythological stories surrounding this larger-than-life character of Joseph Smith. So I think it could jump past Mormon readership, you know, to be some, you know, it's almost like a Harry Potter story. I mean, hopefully, I don't know. I hope that it will get to that point where people might be interested in it, that it's it might jump past the Mormon line of readers, I guess. And then your second question was, remind me just what the word.
Well, I was talking about historical fiction.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I've always hated historical fiction, so I don't, you know, here I am now. But, so, yeah, because I love to have the details right, you know, like, I don't want to accidentally remember, I don't know if you guys like Ten Shoes of the Nephites or whatever, and I was like, wait, they made up somebody's brother. Now I'm going to, like, in a Sunday school or something, I'm going to say somebody had this brother and they didn't even have him, right? So so I try very hard, you know, as part of my upbringing as a aerospace engineer artist, I try very hard to stay within the details. If it's not there, I try not to illustrate it. So it can be hard to do, and yes, I have to use some creative licensing at times to jump from point A to point B to make a narrative. But the current way that I do it is I have a massive Excel document, and each line has a source of where it's coming from. So I will try my best to make it less fan fiction and more coming from somewhere. They are. Do these stories happen? Probably. I'm going to draw something that most certainly did not happen. I'm drawing something that has, though, been told by somebody, if that makes sense. So. Oh, good question. So, yeah, let me see if I have a... Hold on, I have some slides here after some garbage. So throughout the graphic novel, I will have kind of interrupting pages that tell us some more background information, including... I'm going back and forth on that, whether I have a page after each, like, mini-adventure to say, here's the sources... Or if I do, I don't know if I have a page example of it. No, I don't really have it here. But if you come see me at my booth, I'll show you. Any case, I'm debating whether or not at the bottom of each page to have a kind of a source list. Because to me, what I would really like is if everybody just goes and reads the original, like, documents, right? But most people aren't going to do that. But I still want to, like, encourage that, I guess. So... Good question. Right. Well, I think that it is going to be up to... I mean, I guess what I'm going to do is portray it as the events have been told, right? And I will have... I probably will have in the introduction or something, you know, explaining that these are, I'm drawing this from the perspective of someone who believes, has no problem believing in the supernatural and the divine and being the same. I mean, we're starting to do that in the Mormon Church right now. We've got Joseph Smith, you know, he used to just only talk to angels and talk to God through the Urim and Thummim or whatever, but now he's got a stone, you know, magic stone. So I think that that's going to become kind of more of a mainstream thing anyway, like, this is my prediction. I don't know. Let me see if I got anything else. So a lot of questions I get are, like, why do you draw demons the way you do when we know that Mormon theology, you know, they're just fallen spirits. But I'm actually going through and kind of representing them as they've been illustrated at the time. So, you know, these are mostly contemporary-ish drawings. And, you know, all the demon references we have from different sources actually describe them as kind of hairy, creepy old men or you know, Lucy mentions Abraxas here with the snake feet going on. And so they just picture demons in this really unique way, and I didn't want to lose that because I feel like their understanding of Mormonism wasn't there yet, so I'm drawing it as they may have seen it. So, all right.
So when's this coming out?
Okay, so I'm telling everyone 2 years, so just to put pressure on me. I don't know. I mean, I hope this 2 years. I'm working full time on it now. My wife is very kind in letting me do that full time. So other than being a stay-at-home dad, which I can ignore him, I'll get it done in 2 years. So just kidding. Yeah.
It seems like this is really good. But it seems like, you know, like there's a Heber C. Kimball one with the revolutionary soldiers watching, yeah, walking across the sky. Yeah. It seems like you'd probably want to include, like, in the appendix, you'd like to want to have the entire quote just so that, yeah, people could tie it all together.
Yeah, and again, I didn't bring my big portfolio, but that's good. Like, I mean, like I said, I love the original documents. I think that I don't want to lose anything from those documents either. So at times, I'm going to definitely include the full text of it because it's just too great. And I feel like it builds the world, just the quotes themselves. So,
now to kind of derail the conversation.
No, go ahead.
Just as you've been going about through this, and you said it's very different from what you had worked on previously, and, yeah, kind of a very new endeavor for you. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the medium itself of graphic novels and all of that,
sure,
like, one, what have you learned about that process that perhaps you didn't know before you were getting into it? And also, do you have any, like, influences within that medium? In other words, like, even secular, like, aside from this project, like, do you have any, like, favorite?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Favorite? Yeah. Okay, so as far as, man, I don't think I included that either. Oh, I did. check it out. So this is the process that I've learned. I mean, I have professors from art school back in the day that I've been talking with. They're all in the comic book industry. I know a couple guys that are in the comic book industry here in Utah, actually. And they're all excellent, and they've been able to help me through this process because this is my first time doing a graphic novel. You know, I am a storyteller. I majored in animation, but I haven't really had a chance to pursue that as a concept artist for an aerospace firm. So so this is exciting for me, but I am learning. So I've kind of been building my own pipelines, building my own processes to how to make it. So my the way I do it is traditional up until inking, and then I go to digital for painting, lettering, and compositing. So I think I got all your questions. I don't know. What was the last one? The influences. So I do like comic books, and I feel like it's the you know, there's lots of people who have written these awesome documents, and like that lady over there, Sandra. She, you know, lots of great books out there, you know. But I'm not a writer, and I'm not really a historian. I'm just kind of a guy, right? So, but this is something I can do. So I feel like that a graphic novel might reach a different type of audience. But yeah, everybody, if you really want to know the facts, you got to go read big, dusty books, you know. So
go ahead. So first I want to comment on... Go ahead.
Sorry, I just realized I forgot my influences. Hellboy, if you guys like Mike Mignola. Let's see. There's a lot. I mean, I have a huge stack, I guess. Watchmen, I'm thinking of when you think of, like, taking a narrative and interrupting it with documents that kind of build the world. He does that quite a bit. Let's see. If you guys, there's a graphic novel called Petrograd. I love it. It's a Rasputin. Well, is it Rasputin? I forgot what it's. Yeah, Rasputin, kind of Russia thing. There's a lot of great stuff out there. I don't know if I can name it, everything, but Hellboy is probably the main influence. Okay, sorry.
So first, I want to comment on how you introduced the talk, and you said you're taking the accounts at face value.
Yeah.
And in response to that, I would say, this is Mormon history. How dare you? second, I want to ask you, do you think that this being the graphic novel and being the truly embracing the mythical character of Joseph Smith mm-hmm. that's been constructed through these accounts, do you think that that might broaden the appeal to a non-Mormon audience that reads a story like this and says, wow, Joseph Smith is larger than life. I better go pick up Rough Stone Rolling mm-hmm. to see how much of this is legitimate. And then maybe that might lead them into, you know, D. Michael Quinn's early Mormonism, the magic worldview. Mm-hmm. So I'll get your response to that. And then I have a follow-up after that.
Okay. You guys, I'm not great. Oh, thanks for stopping there. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I hope so. I guess that would be my goal is like I said, just it's such a different type of medium. I feel like can reach a different audience. I hope that they would look at it, kind of fall in love with the story and even the characters. But, you know, I feel like at least Joseph Smith, like it definitely changes my perspective on Joseph as I've read so many of these stories. Like it just makes him more real, more human. I don't know. I can't predict the path people would follow after that really, but... You know, I would hope that they would find some of that cool stuff.
Yeah. Fingers crossed, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So then a follow-up then. So many of the accounts of Joseph's magic and occultism, if they are illustrated or if they are read out of the context of the magic worldview, mm-hmm. it seems very wacky to us. Mm-hmm. So my question would be, how much are you going to go to Agrippa's occult philosophy mm-hmm. or the Magus? How much are you going to use those as source materials
right.
in order to contextualize the spells and the sigils that he was creating and the treasure digging mm-hmm. rituals and the witch hazel sticks? How much are you going to use the original source material that Joseph was likely exposed to
right.
that puts all of that information into the occult context?
Sure. Just like with storytelling, you don't, I mean, there's different ways to approach it, but for me, I'm going to, like I said, kind of build it small. Luckily, I think some of the early accounts, you know, William Stafford has a great account. He's there. It's his firsthand account, right, of this is the way they made this magic circle. This, you know, the stakes, that, like you said, the witch hazel stakes they put in the ground and the iron stake in the middle, or steel stake, I think. And he describes that whole process. So it might be kind of like, whoa, what's going on here? And then later we get to a little bit darker magic and some more interesting things. So we'll start kind of small. As far as like, I'm not a specialist in the Magus or some of the other books. I actually have questions. If someone is a specialist at that, I would love to talk to somebody. I know, I've read your stuff. I guess like, you know, there's like one account, for instance, it says, is it Willard Chase probably? He goes and he has to call out a certain name to retrieve the plates. And I'm like, well, geez, what name? Like, what is this name he could possibly be saying? And I don't want to make something up. So I would love to have a source where it's like, you know, perhaps he's referring to Raphael or some, you know, like some other angel or something, right? So, yeah, that's something I have the copy of the Magus and stuff. I'm just going to get into it to try to be more historically accurate. Yeah.
Final follow-up, how much Masonic symbolism will you be incorporating as well?
Well, good question. So, obviously, if I got to Nauvoo, there would be a lot more. You know, even the plates descriptions, the one on the left here that the skinny one, Joseph Sr.'s description to Fayette Laugham, talks about the second page of the plates. Well, there's a cover page under that. The way he describes it is there's the seer stone or spectacles right under it. You turn the page, the next page is covered in Masonic symbols. So let's see. I don't know. I'm trying to think of any other examples that I've run into with Masonic symbols, but they do describe them on the plates themselves. Okay, so that's a tough one. Some of the stories about animal sacrifice are Lumen Walters, right? So, first of all, that's great that we can introduce it with Lumen and not be just completely turned off immediately that this is something that Joseph might have done, right? So again, building small, starting small. There is plenty of stories that talk about an animal sacrifice to break the binding or the magic seal or whatever it is that's guarding the treasure that he may be pursuing. But I think that, you know, I mean, I'm just going to draw it as it is. I hope that people won't be completely turned off by that, but it's something that happened back then. And there's a few examples of, you know, a lamb, a dog, a sheep. All of those things get killed at some point. Not necessarily by Joseph himself, but he's there when it happens. So, yeah, for sure. You guys familiar with those? Any? Raise a hand. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell us what some of those Masonic symbols in that painting you showed us at the end, what some of those mean.
The painting at the end. This guy?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So actually on here there's not any Masonic symbols. There is, let me go back to the first slide. Sorry, there's my working slides down there. I hope you didn't see them. Okay, so here... this one doesn't really show it either. Well, here, you can visually see it here. So behind Joseph's head here, to draw this, oh, wait a minute, hold on. You guys just hang on 1 second. There we go. To draw this, I've gone for a couple things here. Anyway, behind his head is a magic circle. Sorry, I'm going to go back. That wasn't that great after all. And that's what they would draw on the ground at times whenever they needed to dig. They would draw around the treasure, and a lot of times they would then dig in silence. The stakes would go on the second circle around the outside. At least they would do circles, not always. I haven't really found any accounts where they actually carve in the symbols in the ground, but there's probably something out there. And then the other items around the edge here actually come from the Jupiter talisman of Joseph's. So there's like Hebrew down here, the symbol of Jupiter, the path of Jupiter, and the seal, I believe, of Jupiter. But you'll have to look up a little more detail about that if you want to learn more. There's a lot of discussion about that the Jupiter talisman isn't legit anymore, but, you know, nobody will really ever know, but it's something that's surrounding the mythos of Joseph, and I decided, even with this painting, that I was going to incorporate things that are around him, whether they're real or not. Sorry for the people that, yeah, maybe don't want that, but go ahead.
So is there a running plot with this?
Yes.
Joseph has an ultimate aim?
Well, okay, so first of all, I'm drawing it where you don't know what Joseph's thinking, so we're not inside his head, so it's going to be kind of up to the reader. But I do have a plot, you know, plot line, I guess, of that kind of leads from one treasure dig to the next, some great stories in between, some humanizing stories, like I said, and ultimately the plot, you know, eventually the whole overall story is his call to action, or, you know, call to the magical world, entering the magical world, going through some trials and ordeals in the magical world, coming back. Out of that, like a different, stronger person, and becoming a prophet. So, yeah.
You're going to illustrate somebody trying to kill him at 14?
Good question. So, let's see. I'm starting generally, I don't remember the year on that, or if there is a year on that, but
14 years old.
14, yeah, see, so I'm starting 1820, 1819. There might be some flashbacks. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I feel like that's when it really gets into it. And, yeah, I'm probably going to go back and do a first vision kind of recap and some things like that. But, you know, most of the time the story starts with Joseph with his leg, you know, that story. And I'm kind of jumping ahead, I guess. Yes, so that's the main, you know, the topic or title, I guess, of the book itself is called The Glass Looker. So when I first started out, that was going to be, I guess, that's going to be the defining moment, right? And it is, I feel like, still, it's like a moment when, you know, he goes on, if you can imagine, like, he goes through some treasure digs, you know, a couple we show in great detail, and then all of a sudden he's on this, like, the superhero montage, you know, where the superhero's, like, rescuing the cats and the school bus full of children. Like, he's going through so many treasure digs down there and Harmony and Bainbridge and Windsor, and then all of a sudden, you know, it gets a little check back to reality when he has to endure a proceedings in 1826. So I find that to be like a really pivotal moment, and that's how I chose to call it that. Yeah, but some great stories from that particular trial. Right. Yes. Okay, so yeah, I've traveled up to Palmyra and I've photographed every place that I can figure out where the digs were. I don't know if anyone's familiar with Dan Vogel, but he has a document called The Locations of Joseph's Treasure Digs. I think I'm summarizing the title there. It's probably a lot longer. But in general, as far as I know, most of those holes were not filled in, although there is some examples of like a cow falling in later and dying. And so, yeah, they filled it in later. One of them, I think it was a salt well, a cow fell in and drowned from the rainwater. So they finally filled it in. But that was years later. That was like way after Joseph was gone. So, but I still think you can find, oh, if you do travel out there, there's one of the holes or caves that he dug is still visible. Miner's Hill Cave, which there's been some people who have gone out there and taken photos and re-excavated it. It's attributed to him. You know, we'll never know if these are actually him or if it's just because he became the most famous treasure seer in the area that now everyone's telling, well, actually, this hole was dug by Joseph, you know. And I'm not going to figure out that. I'm just saying these are stories that are attributed to him. So, yeah. All right. Awesome. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yes. So, oh, yeah, okay, good idea. So it's been asked, you know, where could you learn about something like this if you're not familiar with it? What are some sources you could go to? Did I get that right? Kind of. Okay, so I would say, Even Rough Stone Rolling kind of delves into a little, you know, it's a if you want to do kind of a faithful route, I would jump in there. There's, if you're kind of a believer's route, there's D. Michael Quinn's book. He's a believer. He has a different way to look at Mormonism. Then there's like the skeptic's route. You got like Dan Vogel. He's written a lot of great books. I like The Making of a Prophet. It's kind of a template for my own graphic novel. Let's see. I would, you know, and then of course the internet. If you're adventurous and you're not, you're okay jumping in there. There's lots of great sources out there, and I like just reading the transcript of the 1826 trial. That's pretty epic. And there's two people in the courtroom that took records, and they, you know, apologists like to say, well, look how different they are, but, you know, I like to think of anytime there's sort of a discrepancy or difference, I'm like, they're just people telling two different parts of the story, you know, like describing a different part of the elephant kind of thing. So there's a guy named William D. Purple who did some pretty awesome notes. And there's a woman, I forgot her name. Do you know her name? Anyone? Samantha Payne, maybe, or is that somebody else? Anyway, there's two sources out there of the 1826 trial, which I think are pretty cool. All right. Do we? All right.